Hi everyone, and happy Hanukkah. We're going to get started in just about a minute. I'm just going to help everyone get a chance to get settled before we get started. And just to remind everyone, this is part two of the three-part series. Last week, we looked at Megillas Antiochus, a Aramaic language telling of the Hanukkah story. And we had a chance to prepare for Hanukkah with that. And this week, we're going to be looking at some traditions and texts around of Toldos Yeshu, which we'll hear about in a second. And we'll finish next week with some additional related traditions tying into the fast of Tes B'Teves, the ninth day of Teves. That's marked on the 10th of Teves, but some of the traditions around why there would be reason to fast on the ninth, also tying into this series on adversaries in Jewish tradition. So we'll give everyone just a couple seconds to get situated, and then we'll get started. I'll just add, everyone is invited to turn on their camera if they're comfortable doing so. It helps me if I'm teaching to people instead of backgrounds or names, all things equal. And I think it helps everyone feel like they're in a classroom style setting. So anyone who can join, it's appreciated. All right. So why don't we get started? So as I just said, last week we looked at the adversary Antiochus in advance of Hanukkah. It's still Hanukkah, but we're coming up on an important date on the non-Jewish calendar, of course, being December 25th. And believe it or not, as we'll see, this day in some Jewish communities is also marked, and also marked around the character, the figure of Jesus, the sort of founding figure of Christianity. But as we'll see, obviously, it's not traditional for Jews to celebrate Christmas in the Christian way, but in a particularly Jewish way. And we'll see that, and we'll see various traditions about Yeshu, Yeshu being the Hebrew word for Jesus. We'll learn about why that is in a few minutes as well, aside from just, being very similar. And so we'll learn about different traditions around that, and that's our plan for today. We'll do some things based on looking inside at sources and some things outside, just because there's too much text to go through all of it. So let's get started. So generally, this, I think, as I said last week, the texts and the material we're looking at are the things that don't necessarily get taught in day school. I would say probably most people in school didn't, in terms of your Jewish history class, if you went to a Jewish school, you don't hear too much about the figure of Jesus. But the truth is there are some materials in Jewish tradition. For various reasons, they've been sidelined. One reason we're going to look at now, I'm going to share the handout, which hopefully people also received by email. But either way, I just turned on screen share. So everyone should have it here. There are various Gemaras that talk about the character of Jesus, again, known as Yeshu. You might not have seen these Gemaras because they were censored. When they started publishing things, in many places, there was someone who would censor the materials, either someone Jewish who was censoring it because they were scared of what the powers that be would think. Maybe they would persecute the Jews if they saw these sources. Or sometimes there was a Christian censor, often with some sort of Jewish background knowledge, and they would do that. So this is a Gemara. If you look in the standard Vilna Shas, the standard printed Gemara, it's not there, but it's been put back in because it was censored. So it was put back in. And for example, online, I got this online from Sepharia. They got it from the Steinsaltz edition. Steinsaltz edition puts it back in. So we'll read this piece of Gemara. This is some of our earliest, the earliest sources in Jewish tradition about the character Yeshu are in the Gemara itself. So we'll start off with this. There are a few. We'll look at this one. So the Gemara here is in Maseches Sanhedrin. It's talking about the different laws pertaining to execution. Sometimes people violate capital crimes. They go to court, and it gets decided that they're going to receive the death penalty. And it talks about some of the details around that, one of which is v'uchroz yotzei lefanav. there's an announcement going out beforehand, meaning before a person gets executed, they translate here as a crier, but some sort of someone shouting, some sort of announcement goes out that so-and-so is about to be executed. So that's what the Gemara picks up on. And now it's going to ask a question. Lefanav in me karalo, that implies only before, but not before they're convicted, only once they're being led to the execution right in front of them, not previous to that. But there's a problem about Tanya, but we learn in a brisa, we have this earlier rabbinic text, which says as follows. And here's where Yeshu comes in. Be'erev Pesach, on the day before Pesach, right on Passover Eve, Tzla'u l'Yeshu, they hanged Yeshu, they hanged Jesus. V'hakroz yotze lefanav mem yom, Yeshu yotze lisakel. And for 40 years, not just immediately before he got hanged, but for 40 days before the execution, they had this announcement, Jesus is being taken out to be stoned. Al shekishev v'hisis v'diaches Yisrael, because he did magic and he tried to turn to idolatry the Jewish people. These are capital crimes, according to the Gemara. These, you know, I don't know the last time they were implemented in any Jewish community, but at least they're on the books as capital crimes. And the Gemara here says they were applied to Jesus. Kol mi sheyodea lo schus, yavo v'yilamed alav. Following the usual rules of court procedure for dine nefashos, for capital cases, anyone who knows, who has an argument in defense of this person, of Yeshu, should come and argue on his behalf, because right, in general, the death penalty is a last resort. We want to give every person as many possibilities to defend themselves as possible in the normal case. So that's why they announced, part of the announcement, he's going to get the death penalty. If anyone has an argument on his behalf, they should make that argument. V'lo matzu lo schus. They didn't find any such arguments. So the conviction holds up. Utzla'uhu be'erev Pesach. And they hanged him on the day before Pesach. So this, first of all, for our purposes, this is a fascinating story of how the Talmudic rabbis thought about the death of Jesus. They're, instead of saying, for many years, the church accused the Jews of having killed Jesus, the Gemara says, yes, that's what happened. There are some people who say this is talking about a different Jesus, not the famous one. That's a non-standard answer. It seems like the Gemara here is saying, once you put back the parts that were censored, that yes, that the court decided he was guilty of trying to turn Jews to idolatry, and he was hanged for that reason. And this also is a contradiction to what we saw before, this idea of announcing the person's being brought to be killed only right beforehand. Here it says it was for 40 days. There's also a technical contradiction. That's why this is brought in, because it seems to contradict the usual rule. So what did the Gemara answer? Amar Ula says, V'tizbara, does this make any sense? Barafuches chusu, do we actually look, turn over and look to try to find some argument on behalf of this person? No, Mesisu, he's someone who is instigating the Jews to idolatry. V'rachmana amar, lo sachma lo sechase ala. We know, this is discussed elsewhere in Masechta Sanhedrin, that someone in general, someone who's accused of a capital crime, we try to find any possible argument on their behalf. However, someone who's accused of turning the Jewish people to idolatry does not have that right. We don't go out of our way to try to defend them. So in this case, we said explicitly that Yeshu is getting the death penalty for being mesis, for trying to instigate to idolatry. So then the Gemara says, we shouldn't be mehapech b'skusa. We shouldn't try to find an argument on his behalf. So what does that mean? How is this teaching true? Ela shani Yeshu the karav l'malchus haba. Yeshu was different. He was different in various ways. First of all, despite the fact that he was accused of and convicted of trying to turn the Jewish people to idolatry, still we're mehapech b'skusa. We tried to find an argument on his behalf. Why? Because he's karav l'malchus. He's close to the government. He got along with the emperor. I think historically this, I don't know how much that holds up. I think according to other accounts, maybe he didn't get along so well, but okay, that's what the Gemara is assuming here. And so he got along well with the government. So they gave him an extra, they threw him the bone. They tried to find another way to get him off the hook, number one. And number two, this also solves the other problem we had raised, that why do you announce it for 40 days, not just for when he's going out to be killed on that last day? Because also you can say he's Karav L'Malchus. That's why he got special treatment. So again, for many years, this passage was censored from any Talmud. Nowadays, it's in the public domain. It's in the Steinsaltz, it's in Safaria. There are many websites. So I don't think I'm revealing anything, any secrets. I think if someone wanted to seize upon this, these sources were already in the public domain. But it seems like the Gemara is saying that the Sanhedrin convicted Jesus of trying to turn the Jews to idolatry and convicted him of that and gave him the death penalty. Okay, so that's a first teaching about Yeshua. And now the Gemara brings in another related one. Tanu Rabbanan, rabbis taught another brisa. Chamisha Talmidim Hayu Lo Yeshu. Yeshu had five different students. And here are their names. Matai, right? Matthew. Nikai, Netzer, Bone, Vitoda. Those are their names. We'll see in a second where these names come from, although Matthew is obviously correlates with one of the names of the authors of the Gospels. Asyuhu Limati. So they, or Matai, they brought Mati in front of the court. Amar Luhu Mati. Mati said to them, to the Sanhedrin, Amar Luhu Mati Yehareg. He said, let Mati be killed. But they said, no, how could that be? Haksin Matai or Masai Abo Ve'eraeh Pneilokim. How can you say that Mati should get killed? Doesn't the Pasuk say Matai? Similar word, right? When will I go and appear before the face of God? So apparently, Mati is good. Mati's going to appear before God. That such a person couldn't deserve the death penalty. Amrullah, they said to him, no, you're reading the wrong pasuk about Matai. In Mati Yeharek, he should get killed. Why? Divsim, Mos Yamus, Masa Yamus, V'Ived Shmo, Mati, it means when, but it also means Mati, this person, Matthew, will die. And his name will disappear. So, and then it goes on for all the other names as well. Netzer, there's a good pasuk. The Netzer Mishar Shav Yifreh. Netzer is like a shoot coming out of the roots in the Messianic passage. So how could he be bad if he's the Messiah? And they say, no, he gets killed because Nishlachta Mikibracha Ken Netzer Nitav. Pasuk that says it's like some abandoned shoot. Same thing for all the other names. So in the end, they find reasons to convict the various students of Jesus as well. We're not going to go through this in detail, but this is one of several passages in the Gemara that tell the story of Yeshu. And again, not so shy about saying what happened to him and even, saying that, yeah, he was executed by the Sanhedrin. Another Gemara talks about how his punishment in heaven, in Shemayim, or in Gehenna, in the world to come, is as to be boiled in burning excrement. Again, I'm not making these up. These are in these passages of the Gemara, but sort of harsh things, which, of course, in historical perspective, one can understand, given Jews at the time were being persecuted by Christians in many different communities. So that wouldn't necessarily lend them to have the most positive attitude towards Yeshu. But in any event, we're just trying to present some of these ideas. So this is one, the Gemara has a whole host of traditions, pun not intended, a whole host of traditions about Yeshu. That's not what we're going to focus on today. We're going to look, although it's going to be related, but we will look at a different text called Toldos Yeshu, which means the generations of Yeshu, or the story, maybe the looser translation, the story of Yeshu. And this is a text. It's a little bit later. It's not from the time of the Gemara. It's post Gemara, it seems. But it definitely draws on various Gemaras. It draws on other traditions. It draws on seems to talk about some Christian teachings, although with its own spin, with a different angle. And again, it tries this in not like in the Gemara. It's like there's one piece here, one piece there, strewn across all of Shas. Whereas here, this is one text, one story. Telling basically the life story of Yeshu, of Jesus of Nazareth, starting with his birth, which we're going to talk about, and going all the way until his death, and even some post-death points, even some points of how how early Christianity developed after his death. I don't, you know, just how to think about this. It's presented as a real historical story. It's not clear to me that that's how it was intended to be read. Is the goal here to tell you exactly what happened? Maybe yes, maybe no. Again, there isn't necessarily corroboration for all these details. You know, I guess someone could read it as a historical account, but certainly what it's definitely doing is it's taking themes that are important to sort of central to the Christian story of Yeshu and sort of turning them on their head in almost some sort of a parody of sorts. So let's learn a little bit about Toldos Yeshu together. Here's a short article, a survey article I took a selection from just to get a bit of an introduction by Mika Ahuvia. Toldo Yeshu is a decidedly non-rabbinic, and it's not really from Chazal, it's not from rabbis, it's maybe a more popular work, counter-narrative and satire of the foundational story of Christianity, which likely originated in the late antique or early medieval period. It probably circulated orally for centuries. So this is very interesting, right? It could be that there were versions of it going around before it was really written down, relatively early, before being transcribed in various places and times. A version of it was known to the Archbishop Agobard of Lyon in 827, who complained of Jews' public and aggressive use of such vitriol to influence Christian converts' attitudes towards Jesus, right? So I think, as you might guess, different bishops weren't so happy about this sort of story. You'll understand better when you get more details. Now, this is relevant for us in terms of timing. According to some late medieval sources, it was a Jewish custom to read Toldos Yeshu on Christmas Eve, meaning usually on December 24th. There actually are two different minhagim around this. We'll talk about this in a second, about Nittelnacht. Has anyone here heard of Nittelnacht? I'm assuming some people have, maybe most people even, right? Okay, I saw a bunch of hands on those with the screens on. So the word Nittel comes from either, well, probably historically comes from the word natal, meaning to be born. Right, like neonatal, right, a newborn. So, like, because it's the day of birth. So, natal domini, the day of the birth of our Lord, is how Christians in Latin might refer to December 25th. And that's why that's one of the that might be what Nittel means. Nittel means the day of the birth of that person, right, of Yeshu. Alternatively, some Jewish sources say that it actually comes not from Nittel with a tes, the way it's usually spelled, but really it's Nittel with a tuf, like nislet, to be hanged. Because as we just saw in the Gemara, tal yuhu, they hanged Yeshu. So maybe Nittel with a tuf means hanged. So it's the day of the hanged person. And some people say, oh, it's because he was actually hanged on December 25th, although it doesn't really fit with any of the stories, either the Christian stories or even Toldos Yeshu itself doesn't seem to fit with that. But maybe it's just the day that the hanged person was born. In any event, so there is a Jewish custom to read Toldos Yeshu on December 24th in the evening. There's a different minhag in some communities to do it 11 days later, because this is like a big, it's fascinating, right? There was a shift in the calendar, right? And when they added a couple of months and they shifted the days, that somehow shifted the whole calendar by 11 days. So some people, you see this in the Christian world too, some people celebrate the end of year Christian holiday on December 25th. Some people celebrate it on January 6th. And the same thing for the Jewish observance of Nittel. Some people celebrate it the night before, you know, December 24th, and some people celebrate it on January 5th, tracking onto the question, you know, I think it tracks onto the, like in Russia, the Orthodox Church does it a bit later. Other, you know, it depends which Christian tradition you're tied to. Jewish communities track that. So that's very interesting. We'll talk about that more in a minute. Let's keep reading here. In the genre of the folk story, it's a folk story, that's in terms of its style, no two manuscripts are identical, right? And this is true. We have over 100 manuscripts of Toldos Yeshu, starting in the Cairo Geniza, or from around the 10th to 12th century CE, in Aramaic fragments, but also going up until the modern period. We have many, many manuscripts, I said over 100, and none of them are identical. There are all these different variations. Why? Because it's not like there was one version of the story. There is the general story, and then everyone had their own take on it. There was some flexibility, as any storyteller could embellish in their telling. So the earliest one seems to be Aramaic, but we don't have a full Aramaic version. And retellings survive in virtually every Jewish language and some non-Jewish languages too. I think it was translated into Latin by a Christian priest. So there's really both Jews and Christians historically were interested in this text. And the academic world, the first academic treatment of this was in 1902. Although in the last two decades, all of a sudden there have been a bunch of studies of Toldos Yeshu in different academic contexts. And it's sort of having a revival, which is interesting. I think partially because, I think at some point maybe people would have said, well, it's not the most friendly text, and people wanted to stay away from it. But I think now people say, look, you know, what's out there is out there. Let's discuss it. Let's not hide from things that are there. So it's an interesting phenomenon. So this is a little bit about some of the a very short summary of an introduction. And in terms of the sources, mentioned here in an article by David Beale. Right, again, it's a compilation of stories told about Jesus in the early church. Original date of composition is unclear. He says it might be late Talmudic or Gaonic. And variants appear in Aramaic or Syriac fragments, right? So that would indicate maybe that it's a bit older. And then, this is fascinating, Voltaire thought it was from the first century and even predated the Gospels. So if you ask Voltaire, sort of a bit random, but if you ask Voltaire, this is the original story before the Gospels, the most ancient Jewish writing which has been transmitted to us against our religion. I mean, this is not true historically, but I don't think anyone thinks it's from the original version of the story, but in any event, really fascinating. So this is the text of Toldos Yeshu, and as was mentioned, there's a minhag among some to read it on Nitzel. So what's Nitzel? So I said Nitzel is around December 24th or January 5th, the night before the day of celebrated by Christians. And we actually have we have some sources for this. So here's an article about Nitzel. I mean, one of the things he cites here, it's hard to get this in the original. So I cited it secondhand, but the Chavos Yair, Rav Yair Bachrach, has a commentary on Shulchan Aruch. It's not terribly well known, called Mekor Chayim. And he said it was recently published. But what does he say? He mentions in Simen Kuf Nun Hey, he talks about Minhag Bitul Halimud Bileil Chuga Ploni. Says there's a minhag to cancel learning on a certain evening, on a certain night. And it's obvious he's referring to the night before, the night before December 25th. There's a minhag to cancel learning. And in many communities, especially in Eastern Europe, especially in Hasidic communities, this was the minhag. It still is the minhag in some people. Some Hasidic communities don't learn December 24th at night. There's different stories about different ideas what one should do. There's like a running joke that you can't tear toilet paper on Shabbos. So you want to prepare for Shabbos, you tear all the toilet paper for the rest of the year on Nitzel Nacht. That's one solution. It's like a bit of a joke. Or apparently some people had the minhag to play chess on Nitzel Nacht. Because if you're not going to learn Torah, what do you do? At least in some communities, right? Where Torah is sort of the standard thing to do. So they would play chess on Nitzel Nacht. Different minhagim. But again, this is a live practice in some places. Among other things, here from a summary of Sefer Minhag Avosenu B'Yodeinu, he says that Yeshnav Shenagu Likro B'Yom Zeh at Sefer Toldos Yeshu. Some people have a minhag of the practice of actually reading Toldos Yeshu on December 24th. You can't learn Torah at the least. So, in Yad Diyoma, the relevant matters of that day, read the story about Yeshu from a Jewish perspective. Right, and again, he describes it. Sefer Ivri Mimei Abinayim, a medieval Hebrew text, Hamukdamim Shegam Turgam LeYiddish, was translated to Yiddish. Right, so presumably in Europe they'd be reading the Yiddish version. All things equal, Hamatziget Korotav Shel Yeshu B'Tzura LaAganit. Right, that sort of tells the story of Yeshu in a manner of ridicule. And Kvokin Ofia B'Meah HaChasre in the 19th century appeared Megillas Nitzel. The Megillah of Nitzel, right? So last week we talked about Megillas Antiochus. Apparently there also was some version of Toldos Yeshu, which was called Megillas Nitzel. Fascinating. Hamigolelas is Koros Yeshu, again, ridiculing the story, the life of Yeshu. Miyuches is Lechmi to be Chassam Sofer, attributed to the Chassam Sofer, Shehendigom Yisavdim, Shehaya Munachim Etzel Rabo, from that he had this book and one of his students copied it. Actually, the Chassam Sofer himself was not a big believer in Nitzel Nacht. He says there's no basis for it and you shouldn't waste learning. You should just learn. So that's interesting. And in general, I think, the yeshivish community is much less observant of Nittel, if at all, than the Hasidic community. But anyway, that's a detail. But the point here is, he mentions how some had the minhag of reading Toldos Yeshu on Nittel Nach. The truth is, if you look for an early source for that, you can't really find a Jewish one, which is interesting. There are very few Jewish sources that say, oh yes, you read Toldos Yeshu on Nittel Nach. Interestingly, there are Christian sources that complain about this from a fairly early date. So some of them are cited here. Very interesting article by Mark Shapiro, who I believe teaches for Torah in Motion regularly. He has an article on this topic, Torah study on Christmas Eve. And one of the things he mentions, the article is mostly about Torah study, but he says a most significant passage that does not mention the practice of abstaining from Torah study on Christmas Eve is found in the writings of the notorious apostate Johann Pfefferkorn, right in the 15th, 16th century. And he says, and this is key, he notes that Jews secretly read Toldos Yeshu on Christmas night. And this is the earliest source back in the 15th, 16th century, the earliest source of this idea of reading Toldos Yeshu, not in Jewish sources, but in Christian sources. And he writes, they believe and maintain that, right, the Yeshu, punished by God because of his apostasy and false teaching, has to wander in all pits of excrement and latrines throughout the world on this night. And this is based on the Gemara. We didn't see this inside, but a different Gemara says that his punishment is to be boiled in boiling excrement, interestingly enough. So he's citing this tradition as it was, you know, colloquially said. It's not a precise quote, but therefore, all latrines around the world, all sorts of, right back in the day, they didn't have the nice toilets. You'd have a latrine, a little, you know, place where people would go. And that's where he would have to wander on that night. And that's why this person said from his youth, because he was an apostate, right? He started off Jewish. When as a kid, he was scared. He would always go to the bathroom outside the privy, outside the usual bathroom, because of a worry of Yeshu that he was going to be hanging out around the latrine. Really a remarkable passage. But we see from here, this is the earliest source for the idea that Jews read Toldos Yeshu on December 24th. And a similar point also tying into to this idea of going crawling around, right? The quote was, they would say, at this time, the Mamzer crawls through all Mashovin. The Mamzer, the illegitimate child, we'll talk about that more in a minute. Referring to Yeshu, crawls through all the places where one can sit. And maybe that means also the sewers as well. So apparently there was this tradition, again, a similar direction, a sort of ridiculing the figure. And again, one might understand how this could happen in a world where Jews were being persecuted regularly by Christians. This is like a way of getting some sort of payback, so to speak. Also, in terms of the reason for Nittel, right, what we'll just do this quickly, and then we'll get into more text. But why is there a practice of Nittel, of not learning Torah on December 24th? There's a few different reasons that are given. One reason that's given in some sources is, and I think this is more from a Kabbalistic perspective, the idea is whenever you study Torah, it's like a yahrzeit, right? On a yahrzeit, among other things, there's if one's relative, on the day of one's relative's passing, you're supposed to do things, religious things in their memory, so you can do various mitzvos in their memory, right? You eat food and say a bracha in their memory to help their soul grow. You learn Torah, you make a siyum in their memory, so then the neshama should have an aliyah. And the idea is, in some Hasidic sources, the idea is we don't want Yeshu's neshama to have an aliyah. We don't want to benefit the soul of Jesus, so it's better not to learn on December 24th. That's one explanation. Another explanation is, and I think this is a more historical one, but actually brought down by the Chasam Sofer and other Torah sources. And this is Nittel with an N, like the word natal, right? N-A-T-A-L, slightly with a Yiddish pronunciation, Nittel. Another explanation quoted by some traditional Jewish sources, but also some historians, is that apparently in some communities, there would be persecution of Jews on this night. On December 24th, they would go to the shul, go to the Beis Medrash, and beat up the Jews there. So they said, look, if everyone stays home, keep your head down, don't go to shul, don't go learn at night, that's a good way of avoiding avoiding being persecuted, avoiding being beat up or killed on December 24th. So that's I think a reasonable, some historians think that's a reasonable reconstruction, and is actually also noted by the Chasam Sofer and some other traditional Jewish sources as to the reason for not learning on the Nitzel Nacht. Again, I don't think this is practiced. I mean, it's practiced in some Hasidic communities today, but not really too many. And thankfully, there aren't pogroms on a regular basis, in most Jewish communities. Let's put it that way. So that definitely the reason doesn't apply if that's the reason. In any event, let's now we're about a halfway in, and we've looked a little bit at some of the general idea of traditions around Yeshu from the Gemara, and a little bit about Nitzel Nacht, the night of Nitzel, the Eve, December 24th, and we talked a little bit about Todos Yeshu, as a phenomenon. But now I'm going to just summarize outside. It's too much to really look through inside, but we'll summarize outside the basic plot line of one of the main versions of Todos Yeshu and sort of remark on some of the interesting points there, and then we'll go for a textual analysis. So the text says, Todos Yeshu says, this is in the time of King Yanai, King Janius. There was a young woman, Miriam, who, right, if you translate that, that could be Mary, who was married to Yochanan, this figure Yochanan, from a Davidic family. He was learned, he was God-fearing. This is a nice Jewish couple, right? And notice the both Mary, being the mother being married, that agrees with, the New Testament's accounts. And the idea that it's a Davidic family, that fits with an idea of inheriting some, being the Messiah, right? Mashiach comes from the Davidic line. So in some ways, this seems to align with an idea that Yeshu is, at least could argue for being the Messiah, but we'll see. This will turn in a second. This figure, Joseph Pandera, he lusts after Miriam, and one night when her husband Yochanan is out, he enters the house, pretends to be her husband, and sleeps with her, essentially rapes her, and then she gets pregnant and has a son that's named Yehoshua. And Yehoshua, of course, was then shortened from Yehoshua to Yeshu. Why Yeshu? So I think the Christian shortened version is Yeshua, which both can mean, should be short for Yehoshua, but also can mean salvation, right? So there's a theological idea there. So I think one of the suggestions is Jews refer to him as Yeshu, as we saw in the Gemara, not Yeshua, because if you say Yeshua, you're implying that he's a savior. If you just say Yeshu, you're not implying he's a savior. But in these Todos Yeshu texts, they spell out why. They say Yeshu, Yud Shin Vav. They say it's an acrostic. It says that stands for Yimach Shemo Vizichro. Again, a very harsh condemnation. May his name and memory be wiped out. Or another suggestion is, they also mentioned another text, he was known as Jesus, Yud Zayin Vav Shin, or Sin. I'll put it in the chat. Jesus, like that, stands for Yimach Zichro Ushmo. Again, the same thing, just flipped. So, a harsh condemnation based on the name, but it's wordplay, right? This is a parody of sorts, or a criticism through parody, and it uses the name as well. But in addition to that, what I just mentioned about how he was conceived, right? He was conceived in sin through a rape, right? That's the storyline, and of course, this is a twist on the Immaculate Conception, right? The idea that he was born when his father was away, when his mother's husband was away, so he couldn't have a father, must be the son of God. Right here, obviously, there's another suggestion of how he could have been born when the father was away, which is this example that Joseph Pandera comes in and attacks him. Also, the name Pandera is used in different places, including in rabbinic literature, to refer to Yeshu. It's like a last name of sorts. My grandfather, who came from Eastern Europe, said that the name they used to have was Yashka Pendrick. That was the name they would use to refer him. Yashka, right? Of course, shortened form of Jesus, but Pendrick is similar to Pandera, right? Yeshu Pandera. Anyway, so this is the story of how he's conceived. Then it says he's born, he gets a bris, he's circumcised, he goes to a Jewish school, he's learning, but then at some point he starts either walking around with an uncovered head, right, not showing respect to the tradition, or in other versions he starts challenging whether Moshe could have written the Torah, right? Obviously this is foreshadowing the teachings of rejecting the Torah that some attribute, that definitely Christianity at some point takes on, attributing that to his, in school, his rebellion against how could Moshe have written the Torah. And this leads the rabbis, especially Rav Shimon ben Shetach, to say, wait a second, there's something wrong here. This person, this child, must be somehow problematic. They investigate. They say, is this child conceived in sin, right, through illegitimate, like, you know, not through through Ashish, through illegitimate adulterous relationship, which, of course, according to the story, he was. Or maybe the child of Anida, maybe his mother was Anida when he was conceived, which would also be bad, or maybe both. One text suggests that both. And they, right, they found out all these details. They find out all these details of how he was conceived, and then they kick him out of yeshiva, right? That's, you know, you're rebelling too much, and you have this sordid past. Well, they throw out yeshiva, so he flees to the Galilee. Of course, this ties into the story of Jesus, who was coming from the north, coming from Galilee. One day, he finds himself in the temple, and right by the temple, the Evan Shesia, the foundation stone in the Holy of Holies, used to have written on it the divine name, the Shem HaMeforash, the explicit divine name. And used to be, you really shouldn't go in, but if you go in, you could see the name. But as soon as you would try to remember it, there were these lines that would roar when you would leave. It would make you forget it. But somehow he found some trick to write down the name and hide it. And somehow he was able to remember, to have some record of the divine name, the Shem HaMeforash. And he was able to use that to do all sorts of miracles. This is the source of his power. So notice, this is really a fascinating way of relating to the figure. Instead of saying he never did any miracles, he had no power at all, he was, right, a good for nothing, instead it's saying he actually did have all these powers, except it wasn't him because of the quality of his personality or whatnot. It was because he cheated. He has the Shem HaMeforash, he has the divine name, and was able to do it for that reason. It says he gathered a group of 310 people, declares himself Messiah, Mashiach, talks about these different psukim from Nach that talk about how an Alma, a virgin, on some understandings, can conceive. It says that's his mother, how he's a descendant of David, right? So the claim is he's a descendant from David. Of course, that's only the father he didn't have was from David. And of course, his mother wasn't a virgin because she was actually raped, and that's how he was conceived. But that's right, that's how he's presenting himself according to the story. And he was able to do all these miracles to heal a lame person and make him able to walk again using the divine name. The Sanhedrin hears about this, right? The Jewish court in Jerusalem hears about this, and they tell him, please come join us to discuss. So he rides in to Jerusalem on a donkey, right? Of course, the Ani Verochiv Al Chamor, this idea of the verse in Pasuk in Zechariah, the verse in Zechariah about how the Messiah is riding on a donkey. He's trying to fulfill that. He comes, shows up on a donkey, and then he has a debate. Jesus against the Sanhedrin in front of the queen at the time, Helni Hamalka, Helene of Adia Bene, who was the queen there, and they had a debate, is he a legitimate Messiah or not? And the rabbis say, no, he can't do anything, he can't do any miracles, he's just pretending, but actually he was able to do all sorts of miracles, because he has the Shem HaMeforash, he has the divine name, and that's why the queen at first sides with him. And they bring him in again, he was able to make stone birds fly, he was able to take a millstone, sit on it, and float on the water, right? This is similar to the walking on water theme. And again, he was able to do all of this, and then he was even able to fly himself in the air. This is all based on, according to the story, based on having the Shem HaMeforash, the divine name, to do these miracles. So what happened next? Another character that we might have heard of from Christian sources, this figure, Yehuda Iscariot, or Judas Iscariot, comes in, and he also somehow figures out how to learn the Shem HaMeforash, the divine name, and he also could fly. So they had a sort of flying battle. They had a fight, each of them flying using the Shem HaMeforash. Neither of them was able to win the fight because they had equal powers, because they had the same Shem HaMeforash. But what happened is that they somehow both managed to lose the Shem HaMeforash. They lost the divine name in that fight. And then, at least in one version of Tolzien, it says this fascinating line. It says, because of this deed of Judah, they weep on the eve of the birth of Yeshu. Because of this fight, they lost the Shem HaMeforash. That's a reason why people cry on Nitalna, on the eve of his birth. So that's another reason for Nitalna, right? Not because you don't want his neshama to have an aliyah, not because of persecution, but because it's a sad day, because the Shem HaMeforash, the divine name, was lost. A fascinating, fascinating idea there in the text. And in the New Testament, Judas is the one of the 12 students, disciples who betrays Yeshu. Here he betrays him as well. It doesn't quite say he's a student, but he's also the main enemy. So Yeshu is now captured and he gets punished. They start giving him vinegar to drink instead of water. They put on him a crown of thorns. Somehow his followers come and he manages to escape. And he goes to Antioch, and like Turkey area. He stays there until Passover, until Pesach time. And then he tries to go back to the temple, to the Mikdash, to get the divine name again. Right? So notice there are some similarities and some differences here. In the New Testament, Jesus does not ever leave, as an adult, doesn't leave the land of Israel. He doesn't go to Antioch, but there were Christian communities in Antioch later on. So maybe that's what it's drawing on. And of course, famously, he died, you know, according to the New Testament, he died in Jerusalem near the temple after being there for the Last Supper, right before or on Pesach. So that story does overlap, but he comes back for Pesach again on his donkey. It says actually he comes back on Shabbos, on Pesach and on Shabbos, which I think the theme of riding on a donkey or riding on an animal on Shabbos is an attempt to invoke the Gemara, which talks about Elisha ben Avuya, the denier of halacha and a Jewish tradition in the Talmud, who also violates Shabbat by driving, riding around on a donkey. I think that's being invoked. It says he goes into the temple, he goes into the Mikdash, and Yehuda Iscariot, Judas, catches him, and he's captured. They ask him his name. He says, my name is Matai, my name is Naki, my name is Buni, my name is Netzer. All those names from the Gemara that we saw a few minutes ago, he said that he kept on denying that he was Yeshu. He said his name was one of these other names. So it's clear that this story is building on a version of the Gemara, that these names, he was using the names of his students and saying that they were his own name. Then he was hanged on, according to the story, on Passover Eve, Erev Pesach, which was also Erev Shabbos on a Friday, right? Of course, this is the standard Christian tradition of Good Friday. And then they tried hanging him on a tree. The tree broke. They put him on a carob stalk. And then they took his body down. According to halacha, you shouldn't hang a body for more than a few hours. You shouldn't leave it up until night. So they buried him outside the city. And then on Sunday, the third day, right? This is Sunday, is celebrated as Easter Sunday. What happened that Sunday, the third day? All of a sudden, people said, oh, look, his body is no longer in the grave because he went up to heaven. He ascended. He came back. And that proves that he's the Messiah. He wasn't found in the grave. So, but what really happened, the story says, really, the gardener had taken his body out and put him in the sand and moved him. So now there was this frantic rush. We have to find the body to prove that he didn't miraculously ascend to heaven. And then the rabbis find his body. They tie it to a horse, obviously a degrading way of treating a body, bring it to Queen Helen. And then she says, okay, I'm convinced he wasn't the Messiah. And that's obviously important because the rabbis want to not be superseded. They want the queen on their side. So she sides with the rabbis and against Yeshu at this point. But again, note the parody, right? The idea that the same argument is being made, it's basically the Christian story of the Friday, dying on a Friday, ascending on a Sunday, except that that story is false. In truth, there's a very different explanation for it, right? And that's that someone moved the body and that was debunked at the time, right? So that's the way that Toldos Yeshu tends to tell the story. It talks about how his students went in four different directions all over the world, spreading his teachings. Three disciples in each direction. There were 12 disciples, right? According to that, through the math, which of course also patterns after the classic Christian story. And it says for the next 30 years, there were fights over this between Jews and Christians. And now, pay attention, this is going to help us transition a bit for next week, but we have more to do today. But this one piece at the end of one version of Toldos Yeshu will be important for next week. It says, the rabbis wanted to stop all the fighting, right? All this fighting after his death. Is he the Messiah? Is he not the Messiah? They didn't want fighting. So what did they do? They sent Shimon Kayafa. This figure, Shimon Kayafa. We'll talk about what that name means in a second. But let's say Simeon. They send him to the Christians as like an undercover agent, a double agent. So he goes there. He goes to Antioch. He starts teaching as if he's a student of Yeshu. He does miracles. He passes on all these teachings of Yeshu. He says Yeshu is in heaven next to God. Again, these are classic Christian teachings. You look, it's in the book of Hebrews, says that, letter to the Hebrews. And he says that, what did Yeshu say? And this was the point of going there. Yeshu says to abrogate, to get rid of all of the holidays and fasts. Don't keep Shabbos, keep Sunday, right? The Sabbath is on a Sunday rather than a Saturday. Don't keep Pesach, instead have Easter, right? Celebrate the resurrection. Celebrate the ascension instead of Shavuos. Don't keep the laws of circumcision and the kosher laws. Basically, right, this is the move to move away from observance of Jewish law, which historically took place some point in the first, second, maybe even third or fourth century, some point relatively early on, where there was no longer an interest in keeping traditional Jewish law. It seems like the early followers probably did, right? The early followers, certainly if you were Jewish and you were converted over to become a follower of Yeshu, you probably did keep halacha, but you also believed that this person was a Messiah, even though certainly classical Jewish tradition did not accept that, but that was what many people early on did. That's what this story is certainly saying. And at some point, according to this story, 30 years later, when Shimon Kayafa came and said, no, we shouldn't be keeping the Torah, the halacha. The proper way is to no longer keep these laws. Don't keep Shabbos, don't keep Bris Milah, don't keep Shabbos, do it on Sunday, right? And don't do all of these, don't keep kosher, don't keep all of these Yamim Tovim, let's make up new Yamim Tovim. That basically meant that there would be a clear split between Judaism and Christianity. It's not like you could be basically a Jew, but also believe that Yeshu was the Messiah. That couldn't work anymore. You had to choose. Either you keep Shabbos or you keep Sunday. Either you follow Yeshu or you keep kosher. You can't have it both ways. That was what Shimon Kayafa did. And this succeeded in ending the fighting, because at least of a certain sort, at least there was no more question of what would Judaism be, right? Judaism was clearly Judaism, keeps all the traditional holidays and halacha and kosher and that. And Christianity is clearly Christianity, and they had a whole different set of practices. It wasn't just they also happened to believe in some messianic figure, but it just changed the entire practice of the religion. This figure, Shimon Kayafa, there's two different ways of understanding who it is in different versions of Toldos Yeshu. Some texts say that he was Paul. Paul, of course, the second to main figure in early Christianity, who popularized Christianity across the Roman Empire at the time. And we'll talk about Paul more next week when we talk about Tisha B'Teves, so stay tuned. The other approach, and again, some of these other texts talk about him as maybe this is Peter, also a figure in early Christianity, because Peter, Petrus, means a rock in Latin, and Kayafa, or Kipa, Kaifa, different pronunciations, means a rock in Aramaic. So Shimon Kayafa means Simon Peter. So this maybe was the figure Peter. Whichever figure it was, he did a major job in saving, according to the story, in saving the Jewish people or ending all the strife by moving away from this model of like having Jews and Christians be very similar in practice. Just do you believe in Yeshu as the Mashiach or not? And splitting the two religions, thereby saving that Judaism from being, sort of swallowed up by Christianity. Of course, that didn't stop other issues of persecution against Jews by Christians, but at least that confusion at the beginning was resolved according to Toldos Yeshu. This is the version of the story of Toldos Yeshu, that Paul or Peter was a secret agent for the rabbis, was on the inside. He somehow convinced people he was a follower of Yeshu, but really his goal was to save traditional rabbinic Judaism from, to clearly distinguish it from Christianity in order to save it. Let's jump back in to the shared text. And we're going to look at one fascinating tradition, one short passage from one of the versions of Toldos Yeshu that does something really, really interesting. And we'll close with that, and we'll have some time for questions. In order to understand this passage, we need a little bit of background. We need to look at the Gemara in Shabbos, where in Tractate Shabbat, talking about one of the things that's prohibited it's prohibited to put out fires on Shabbos unless someone's life is at stake. In practice, generally, someone's life is at stake if there's a real fire. But putting that aside, let's say theoretically you have a fire where no one's life is at stake. What about what do you do and let's say a room is burning down and there's a Sefer Torah inside? So here's the Gemara on this. It says Ibailahu. Oh, did I not include? Sorry, yeah, it's here. It's up here. Sorry, start with this. The Mishnah. Kol Kisvei Hakodesh Matzilin Osam Mipnei Hadleifa. One should save all holy scriptures, meaning Tanakh, all works of Tanakh should be saved from a fire, whether we read from them or not, which is interesting. And you can't throw out a biblical book, even if it's written in a different language. Let's say art scroll, English, whatever. Someone has an English Tanakh. You can't throw it out. It needs kinesa. It needs to be treated with respect, even if it's in a foreign language. And then it says, if they not in Korinbehem, why would you not read from the Tanakh if they bittul beis hamedrash? So this is interesting, not really for now, but according there was a tradition not to study Tanakh, at least at certain times of day, because you're supposed to be learning Gemara instead. Don't waste your time with Tanakh. That's a whole other issue, maybe a topic for another time. We're not going to get into that, but that's the Mishnah. So you're supposed to save scripture, right? Torah, Nevi'im, Ksuvim, all the biblical books, you should save if there's a fire. Now the Gemara asks, Ibailahu, HaGilyonin shall save our Torah. The Gilyonim, Gilyon can mean like the margin of the scroll, right? Because legalos can be to golo, you roll the scroll. The gilyon are the things that are there when you roll it, meaning the things on the side. The margins of a Sefer Torah. Let's say you have someone took a Sefer Torah and cut off the margins, just the little scraps on the side with no text on them. Do we save them from a fire or not? There's a whole discussion about it. In the end, the Gemara seems to say we don't. Right? That's here the summary. Gufa ha-gilyonim. Oh, sorry. Yeah, that's the summary. We don't save it. Now the Gemara says Gufa, it was taught ha-gilyonim. Gilyonim, as we said, could be the margins of a Torah scroll. But now it says ha-gilyonim v'sifrei minim. Sifrei minim means books of heretics. So presumably, let's say minim often means Christians. Let's say it means Christian scripture. The books of, let's say, the New Testament. Ein matzilin osam ifnei adleika. We do not save that from a fire. Right? The idea that one has to save something from a fire is only true for Jewish scripture, not Christian scripture. Now, once we're talking about sifrei minim, what does gilyonim mean? Gilyonim might not mean the margins of a Torah scroll, but gilyonim might mean, gilyon could mean a revelation. Legalos is to reveal something, so maybe here it means revelations and other works of heretics, of non-believers, of Christians, are not saved from a fire. So let's look about, okay, so that's really fascinating how we jump from gilyonim meaning margins of a Torah to gilyonim possibly meaning revelations, meaning texts of other religions. Fine, so it goes on to discuss those details. And now, one time there was danger, and that was based on the previous discussion, but now, and this piece was censored, Hashmatas at Censura was censored, but here's the non-censored part. How would these different rabbis refer to Christian scripture? So Rabbi Meir Habakari Le, Aven Gilyon, notice Gilyon, right, like Gilyonim, which can mean either the margin of a Torah scroll or revelations. So Rabbi Meir would call it Aven Gilyon. Aven meaning falsehood, Gilyon meaning revelation, false revelation. But what else is Avon Gilyon? Well, let's look at the other one. Rabbi Yochanan Habakari Le, Rabbi Yochanan would call it Avon Gilyon with an ayin, meaning sin. Sin revelation. Now, what do each of these words have in common? Evangelion or evangelion, whether with an aleph or an ayin, sounds like evangelion, right? Like the evangelium, which is the word in Latin also Greek for the good message, meaning for the gospel, right? That's right, like the evangelism, right? That's the term that's used for Christian teachings and revelations. And notice how this is like a wordplay, Rashi, I think this is a Rashi here, Rabbi Meir Kari Le, Sifrei Haminim, Rabbi Meir called the books of heretics, Evangelion, false revelation, with Eshen Karnosan, Evangela, or Sefer Ungelion, right, Evangelion. Rashi explains, and this is Pshat in the Gemara, that the Christians would call these texts Evangelion, or something similar. And that's why Rav Meir and Rav Yochanan had their own name for it. That was not so positive, right? Again, within this frame of sort of ridicule, Evangelion with an aleph or Evangelion with an ayin. And that's how they would refer to the text. So, and even more interesting, there's a third version of this that we find not in the Gemara itself, but in the Aruch. The Aruch is a 10th, 11th century dictionary who refers to dictionary primarily of the Gemara, who would refer to different texts. He has Aven Gilyon, stone revelation, and he translates Evangelium into the Latin, which is what he did. He translates Latin. And he quotes our Gemara Shabbos. So his text was not Aven Gilyon, false revelation. It was not Aven Gilyon, sin revelation. It was Aven Gilyon, stone revelation. We'll see this will be very relevant in a second. Leaving that all aside, right, this is a passage where the rabbis don't accept, of course, the New Testament or the Evangelium, and they reject it. And this is the way that they, you know, sort of mock it. Again, I'm not not suggesting people do it, but that's this fits with a Chazal that says that right in general, late sanusa is asur. In general, you shouldn't make fun of things except for avodah zara, except for you know false religion. That there's room to make a mockery. That you know there are different mockeries out of other religious ideas. This is an example of that in Chazal. And let's now turn to a passage from Toldos Yeshu in the Leiden edition, the Huldreich Recension, without going into the details of it, 2.5 lines, but really fascinating here. The Ode Kasav Lahem, Sifrei Ksavim, Kzavim. Now this is talking about the figure we talked about just a minute ago, this Shimon Kayafa figure, right? The double agent who was trying to convince Christians to not practice Judaism in order to distinguish between the two religions. It says the Ode Kasav Lahem, Sifrei Ksavim. He wrote these false works. What were they called? Vikara Osam. He called them Avon Kilayon. Not Gilayon, but Kilayon. Notice they sound very similar. Sin. Kilayon is destruction. The sin of destruction. Instead of calling it Evangelium, right? The good word, the gospel, Evangelium, we called it Avon Kilayon. Sin, destruction. Vehem Sabru, but they thought, Shehu Amar, Evan Gilayon. They thought he said, Evangelium. But what did they think that meant? Evangelion, which literally means stone revelation. But now it's going to say it means something totally different. Klomar, what does Evangelion mean? Klomar, Av, Uben, Vigilui, Ruach HaKodesh. Notice what they do with the word Evangelion. They say it doesn't mean stone revelation. They say it means Av, Ben, Father, Son, and Gilion doesn't mean revelation. In general, it means Gilui, Ruach HaKodesh, the revelation of the Holy Spirit. Now, if you know basically one thing about the Christian Godhead, it's that it consists of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. According to this text in Toldos Yeshu, that whole teaching of the Trinity, of the three parts of the Godhead, the Father, the Son, the Holy, that came from Shimon Kayafa, an undercover rabbi trying to convince Christians to change their religious practice, not just their practice, but also their theology. Right, he specifically told them, he convinced them to have this triple Godhead, Father, Son, and revelation of the Holy Spirit, and Ruach HaKodesh. Okay, what else did he do? But Aslam Shimon, Svarim, this Shimon figure, Shimon Kefa, also made all sorts of books, Mitalmide Jesus, from these students of Jesus, Ume Yohannes, and from John. So he also wrote all of the works of the New Testament, right? The different Gospels, including John. The Amar She Jesus Maser Lo Kol Atvarim. He says, I got all these texts from Jesus. I didn't make this up, but really he just forged them. All of the texts, according to this, of the, again, you know, this the whole idea here is to sort of undermine or mock the traditions. So he says, all these texts are actually forgeries, forged by this Shimon Kayafa figure. Vayichtov Shimon Beremez as Sefer Yohannes. He wrote with all sorts of hints the book of John. He thinks all these secrets. We'll call Hevel V'Rayon Ruach. It's all sort of emptiness. But notice the fascinating recreation, the reinterpretation of this clearly building on the Gemara, right? Of Avon Kilayon and Evan Gilayon. These are building on the Gemara in Shabbos we saw a minute ago, translating the Evangelium as either, either sin destruction, which is a variation on sin revelation, or as stone revelation, but it takes it a step further using a medrash, using, right, of course, medrash being a particularly rabbinic interpretation. Rabbis do midrashim that uses this medrash as to what it means. What does evangelion mean? It doesn't mean stone revelation. It means Father, Son, and revelation of the Holy Spirit. It's almost a way of like retelling the story of early Christianity through a midrashic lens, which of course only the rabbis could do. It's really a fascinating inversion, not just for the sense of parody, which is definitely there, but also just to sort of read, you know, if you were thinking like a rabbi about thinking like a midrashist, how might the religion have developed? So I hope in our time studying these texts, we have a sense of what Tolos Yeshu does, what the text does, both the basic storyline, which I shared, and to look at a close look at this one teaching and how it uses Midrashim to invert Christian teachings here with using a Midrash in a fascinating way, and to say that the source of the Trinity, the idea of the Trinity, was actually from a rabbi, which is not what you would usually guess. In order to distinguish between the religions. Again, I think this is all important to be aware of this material, because it's part of our history, part of the fraught history of Judaism and Christianity. The idea here is not to cause more fighting or to provoke, but to sort of, everyone should be aware of what the past held. I think, we can understand where the authors of Toldos Yeshu were coming from, given the historical context. I think being aware of the history and, is helpful in all respects. And I think helpful in terms of getting a sense of how some Jews historically marked this time of year, not by which I don't mean Hanukkah. I mean the end of the secular calendar, studying some of these texts, taking a sort of Jewish perspective, although, maybe not necessarily a historically approved one, not necessarily historians would agree with it, but a Jewish perspective that tells the story, but tells it with inversion and parody as well. Happy to answer questions. I see there's a couple in the chat. I'm not sure. I think a couple maybe were, were a joke of some sort. Right, Immaculate Conception, I guess I use that term not precisely, but the idea of conception without a father, which is, again, that's being parodied here. What equally learned Midrashic documents describe and draw lessons and conclusions about the eventual splintering and war engendering schisms within the Christian faith? I don't know offhand of such Midrashim. I think generally Jewish interest in Christian theology is somewhat limited. It basically comes up in two contexts. One context is this. Texts such as Toldos Yeshu about the very origins of Christianity and its splintering off from Judaism. And then the other place where Christian theology comes up is in the cases of, Hilchos Avodah Zarah, the laws of foreign worship, and, to understand the exact status of Christian religion according to halacha, according to Jewish law. That's when it comes up. I don't know of sort of classical Jewish texts that talk about debates in sort of from a historical perspective. There are like halachic differences potentially between Protestant and Catholic churches, but that comes up. But that's a different sort of thing, I think, from the question. Any other questions either in the chat or feel free to raise a hand and ask.
Yes, I want to tell you, I wrote a poem which I allude to you, and it's published in the Jewish Journal. If you look at the Jewish Journal in my name, Gershon Heppner, you'll see a poem that you inspired.
Oh, okay.
And I contacted John Reeves about it, and I also mentioned him. I thought you should know that.
Okay, well, thank you for sharing that.
Rabbi,
yes.
I davened last year in a Yemenite shul in Eretz Yisrael, and they have, between the parchment, like to protect the parchment, they have like very fine parchment paper. There's nothing is written on it. It's just to protect the Sefer Torah itself. So they put the paper. So could be that what they're talking about, the Gileonot?
I don't think so, because I think that's a more modern technology, I would guess. I think what they're talking about is like when you have, if you have a Torah, right?
The edges,
and you can cut off, in theory, you're not supposed to, in theory, you can cut off the edge, and that would just be empty parchment. But it was once part of a Sefer Torah. So that's the question. Does that have Kedusha or not? Can you, if there's a fire, do you need to go back and save that or not? The answer is it doesn't really have Kedusha in that way. That's the way we seem to rule. But yeah.
Okay. Thank you
for your question. Any final questions? Is Zahav?
Yeah. Yes, I have a question. Given that these you showed us how an undercover Jew trying to subvert it, given how the fact that Christianity was more successful in that period much quicker and more adherence. What does that say about, in other words, if you're going to do successful antics, do it for your own religion. Obviously. Right.
No, so I think that's exactly the point, meaning, and it doesn't spell this out explicitly in our text, but I think this is what many historians have been arguing recently, which is Christianity spread rapidly among those not of Jewish descent. That's exactly the point, meaning what the rabbis didn't want was Christianity to spread among people of Jewish descent, because then that would mean they would be giving up their proper Jewish practice. But for it to spread to non-Jews is great. And the idea of saying, well, you don't need to keep halacha, you don't need to keep all these Jewish practices, we have a new set of practices, that I think is, it doesn't spell this out, but I think historically this is true. That ties in with Paul's teachings about being a descendant of Avram, not being literally a child of a child, but being part of the spirit, the greater spirit of Abraham, and thereby being part of the seed of Abraham. So that interpretation opened up Christianity to the whole world, which of course is the majority of Christians today are certainly not, descended from Jews. That's the point. So moving away from Jewish practice, and which is not spelled out, but implicitly also opening up to non-Jews, that really broadened the appeal of Christianity, but also made it less focused on Jews, which meant that Jews could practice rabbinic Judaism.
I also would quibble with your characterizing that they saved traditional rabbinic Judaism, because at the time of Jesus and afterwards, rabbinic Judaism wasn't traditional. It was the new version of Judaism that came out of the destruction of the temple. There was nothing traditional about
it. Sure. So I think I was presenting the text as argued in Toldos Yeshu, exactly at what point, the thing that we think of as rabbinic Judaism, was widespread observed. Some people say that it was, some historians say that to some degree that was the Pharisees, and there was that group already during the Second Temple. Some people would say that it only developed in that way later on. I mean, definitely some things were different, like, for example, practicing in the temple was a difference in practice, certainly, the time that Yeshu was around and the time that the rabbinic literature was appearing. So definitely were some differences, but how broad those differences were, or whether there was a group that was pre-rabbinic, I think is an open question among historians. Certainly the authors of Toldos Yeshu would say, no, of course, the Jews around the year zero were practicing, the good Jews were practicing like rabbis, like Chazal wanted them to, right? So you don't have to agree with that as a historical matter, but that's certainly what the text is assuming. I see there's a couple of more comments. Much to think about, a lot to discuss. Agreed. Were Hellenized Jews more likely to become Christians? That's an interesting question. I don't know if we have enough evidence to really evaluate that question. But one thing that we can think about, one thing that is relevant, people have argued that part of Paul's theology, it incorporated a lot of Greek philosophy, Neoplatonic, or some version of Neoplatonic philosophy. So to the extent that you accept those arguments, maybe, again, it's hard to know this for sure, but maybe people who were already previously exposed to or supporters of, Greek philosophy were more likely to follow that. But, I mean, at the time, it was sort of hard. Everyone was exposed in some way to Hellenism, meaning Hellenism was just, it's like saying nowadays, in America or Canada, being exposed, who's exposed to American or Canadian? I mean, everyone is, right? Even if you're in the most closed off community, you probably saw, signs saying you should vote for a political candidate. There probably was a lot of pressure on you to vote for one political candidate or other, even in the most closed off society. So everyone's involved. Everyone's part of the culture in one degree or other. So, exactly who's a Hellenized Jew? Definitely some people, a Hellenized Jew in the sense of like, I don't keep Jewish tradition. I'm just a good Roman citizen. Someone like that is probably less likely to become Christian early on, because if you don't see yourself as Jewish, why would you see yourself as Christian early on, right? When Christianity was primarily appealing to Jews. At a later point, when you get to like the fourth century, then Christianity becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire. So then the more Hellenized you are, or I don't know Hellenized, but the more you see yourself as part of the Roman Empire, the more you would want to join that. So it's a bit of a tricky question to answer, both because we don't have all the information you'd need, because the definitions are a little ambiguous and because it changes over time. So that's the complicated non-answer to Janine's question. I see Shoshana posted, was Paul the author of Nishmas Kol Chai, to spread one God consciousness to Gentiles when he was undercover? Great question. There definitely are traditions that say that, and we will discuss some of them next week. Okay, any final questions?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Rabbi?
Yes.
So did the rabbis kill him or did the Romans crucify him? I mean, did they say anything about the Romans in the Gemara or not?
So the Gemara that we saw in Sanhedrin there says that the Sanhedrin right. decided he would get killed, and he was, and it was not done by the Romans. That's what the Gemara says. As a historical matter, I think most historians think it was actually done by the Romans, not by the Jews. But that's what the Gemara says. Again, what's the goal of that Gemara? Is that Gemara to tell history? Is there some other goal that's non-historical? A fair question. But that's what that Gemara seems to say. And again, as I said, some people say that Gemara is talking about a different Yeshu with students. That doesn't seem to be what our Toldos Yeshu text would imply. Our Toldos Yeshu text seems to connect that Gemara to to the actual Jesus story. Okay, any final questions?
Okay, please look at my poem.
Okay, sounds good. All right, everyone have a wonderful rest of Hanukkah, and everyone's invited to come back next week.
I just wanted to say one other thing.
Okay.
Stone Chumash, it's an unfortunate name.
The oven, Gilead. Yeah. Yes.
Does anybody point that out?
I think you did in the chat. Obviously that wasn't the cause for the name, but certainly. All right, everyone should have a wonderful rest of Hanukkah, and see everyone back next week.
Thank you. Have a Hanukkah Sameach.
Thank you.
Thank you.